On this, the 181st episode of the Open Paddock Podcast for Monday, March 25th, 2013, it's We Love Canada Night, Hinch and Hargrove Mount Canadian Invasion in St. Pete. Now, late in the stages of Malaysia, Doug and Mike were ordered to hold position. Mike overtook, Doug got mad and decided not to be a part of the show tonight, so that's why Brian McKay is on probation. The Open Paddock team is now in shambles. And we also have the Malaysia GP wrap-up on this very special episode of the Open Paddock Podcast. And that's right. Sean got so mad that he put Brian on probation. Even though Brian had nothing to do with this.
Doug got the call from Sean. Doug, Mike is faster than you. Do you copy?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so Doug has been... Well, Doug is not fired because none of us have the authority to fire, but he is currently on super secret probation, I guess.
Doug is at Game Developers Conference this week, and he has better things to do than to chat up racing with all of us peeps. So we had to make up a reason for why he wasn't here, and Malaysia was as good a scapegoat as any.
Well, that and kidnapped by Mexican drug lords just wasn't going to cut it.
Well, Mexicans don't like Doug. Oh, Lordy. So, I just opened my second beer for the evening, so it's going to be a great night.
What's your selection of choice tonight, sir?
Oh, Ballast Point Sculpin IPA. Good stuff. If you can ever find it, it's worth it.
Mike Shaw, are you enjoying an adult beverage up there?
I am. I've got myself a classic gin and tonic with a sprig of mint.
Oof. Wicked awesome. Speaking of wicked awesome, I've got Sam Adams Cream Stout tonight.
Ooh, look at you.
Stuff. Way to go, man.
Getting all whacked out with that blood sugar of yours.
Yeah, I'm a little bit loopy right now, so I've decided to let the other five rest for now.
Nice.
Otherwise, this might be the most interesting episode of the Open Paddock Podcast we've ever had.
Nice.
You got your Novolog Flex Pen nearby, right?
Yes.
No, thank God I'm actually not on insulin. I use this lovely little pill called Metformin. If any of you out there are diabetic, you know all too well about the horrible side effects of Metformin, so I don't have to go into that. But, yeah, I'm actually almost to a point now where I can stop taking Metformin. So,
oh, cool.
Congratulations,
well,
sir. That's a hard job to do.
That's worth celebrating with five cream stouts.
in all seriousness, over the past 3 years, I've dropped a little over 100 pounds.
Oh, dude, congratulations.
When I first started being treated for diabetes, when I had to check into the hospital one day with it, my blood sugar was 431, and when I took it just a little while ago, I was sitting at 95. So
nice,
yeah. So me and Charlie Kimball, you know, we rock it out together.
You talk shop.
Yeah. Ironically enough, one thing I did witness actually at the open test at Barber a couple of weeks ago is I was just kind of. Everybody had hot pit access, which was awesome, by the way. And I was just walking behind the wall, and Charlie was getting ready to hop in his car. It was just after lunch, and I saw him check his blood sugar as he was getting into the car, just like he says he does. So that was kind of neat.
Sweet.
So, yeah.
All right.
Speaking of IndyCar, let's get the show underway. And as I said on my article on the website, there's no need for a runoff or a recount or even a recall. Mayor wins in St. Pete.
Landslide victory.
Picking, well deserved, too.
Picking off both Penske's on restarts. That was pretty cool of him.
It was pretty amazing, but I have to say that on that last restart there where we were coming off, where he took Elio when we were coming off the caution flag for Saavedra, mm-hmm. James Hinchcliffe does not win that race if Elio does not slide the back of that car out.
That's a fair statement. Elio, he overshot the corner, and it got loose on him, and he had some issues.
Well, but at least from what you see at that point, but do you think he would have been able to hold him off? Because wasn't Hinch the only one still on the primary blacks instead of on the reds?
And that's also true, and that's why they're saying that Elio didn't have anything for him in the closing stages. Is
right.
Tire,
I mean, he could end up like De Silvestro.
Oof.
I'll say this, though. There are not many drivers in the series that are better than Castro Neves when he's out front.
Yeah.
And that's where the wily veteran kind of takes precedence over the third-year driver. Is I honestly think that Castro Neves could have held Hinch off. But all that's moot because he didn't. And I was very impressed by that last 26-lap stint where Hinch was in the lead.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't like he ran off and left Elio either. Elio was pushing him up until probably about the last lap or two.
Yeah. Yeah. This weekend looked like a runaway and hide weekend for Will Power. He led, you know, St. Pete practice. He broke track records and qualifications. Took the pole, and he went off and hid in the first stint. He was all 5 seconds ahead of the rest of the field. But you know, that qualifying, let's talk about that a bit. What was that? Yeah. What was that in the Fast Six?
That was just crazy, is what it was. I mean, you had Simona up there. Yeah. You had Tristan Vodier. I mean, let's see, who else was it? Hinch was up there.
Takuma Sato was right up there, yeah.
And Tristan Vautier, you know, assistant crepe maker at crepe maker at Schmidt Hamilton Motorsports.
I would love to see Vodier make a crepe with Pagenaud. I really would.
I bet they're both pros at it. I think Pagenaud's shown him a few things since he's been with the team.
They need to make a little video like for their team, like talking about Pagenaud passing the torch to the rookies or something like that, and teaching Vodier how to make a crepe at the track or something like that.
Oh man. But yeah, I mean, the rookie Tristan Vautier getting into the Fast Six and you know, showing well. Simona, I mean, this has to be such a wonderful weekend for her. She ended up finishing well, even though she kind of dropped off at the end of the race. She had a great race and she qualified third, and she's sitting there going, oh, thank you.
She was so happy. I mean, you didn't see a more jovial driver than her throughout that whole thing.
I think the only thing that might have burst her bubble that weekend was when Hildebrand went flying by under yellow. She about had a little fit there on the track, but we'll talk about that later.
Yeah, I've been given some information about that I can't share on the actual show, so I'll have to tell you all later.
Okay.
It wasn't, you know, her that fell back really at the very end. It was her car, right? So I mean,
she just went off the tire cliff.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
And they don't slowly slough off right now. They're it's a cliff. When they go, they go.
I was amazed that she was able to hold on for as long as she did, honestly. Because let me tell you, Marco Andretti came up through there like his rear was on fire and his head was catching.
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't seen him run like that in a long time. But it's like I also said in my article, I'm not sold yet on air quotes, the new Marco, because he's always run well at St. Pete. He's typically run well at Barber as well. So we really need to hold off until Long Beach to see what he really has.
Yeah, I mean, the new Marco, if you want to put it down to anything, the new Marco comes down to he's got really competitive teammates that he respects. And yeah, he's probably closer to than any teammate he's been with in years. That makes him want to be better. And
I mean, I'm looking at the box score for St. Pete right now. Mm-hmm. The worst finishing Andretti driver was Hunter Ray, who finished 18th because of an electrical issue.
Yeah. Yeah.
But otherwise, Andretti finished first, third, and seventh.
And seventh, that is EJ Viso in seventh. You're like, wow. Wow.
Yeah, and if you, I don't know if any of you read the transcript of the post-race interview where they talked to Michael Andretti. And Michael was talking about how he felt bad because they kind of screwed over EJ in practice and qualifying by putting bad strategy on him. Mm. Because he said there's
he was playing a strategy game and he got the short end of the stick.
Yeah, and there he's because he was mentioning that EJ is still trying to get used to them. They're trying to get used to him, and the strategy just didn't pan out. So he had to start further back in the field than he really should have, which was 22nd, by the way. He went from 22nd to 7th.
Yeah, without wrecking anybody, which is quite an accomplishment for EJ.
Well, you know, he looked a lot better last year in that regard, too.
Yeah, that's true.
He wasn't really tearing a lot of gear up last year. And he's a veteran now. He's showing patience, and he's waiting for moves to happen instead of always trying to make the move.
Yeah. Though,
so, you know, I have to admit that I missed most of the race on the very end of it. So, you know, it sounds like I was hearing that Dario brought out the first caution.
Yeah, Dario was pushing hard on equipment that wasn't nearly as good as anybody else's. Chip was complaining about the Honda engines early on the weekend, and he said some pretty inflammatory things. We'll get to that after we cover the race. But as far as things go, you know, Dario's working it out. Now, Dixon did okay with that equipment, but Dario may have been pushing too hard too early because he ended up putting the car in the wall on lap 20 and brought out the first caution. The restart to that caution was interesting, though, because it appears that anti-stall seems to work occasionally.
Yeah, back to Dario for just a second, though. He was coming out of the, for those of you that didn't see it, he was coming out of the pits. He was on cold tires. He was pushing, trying to save some track position, and he just kicked it out into the marbles and just smacked the wall. I mean, it was a very un-Dario-like move, I'll put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe a lot of that attributes to the fact that he knows that right now something is up with that Honda. And he was really trying to push it just so he wouldn't fall backwards.
Mm.
So that's one of those that you win some, you lose some, and unfortunately he lost it on lap 18.
Yeah. Then, like we're saying, on lap 25 we had a restart. And Bia, James Jakes, Charlie Kimball, and EJ Viso all ended up spun out and turned around and, you know, a complete stop on the track. And all four of them took off again. No problems.
Yeah.
That's impressive. Yeah, that was a big issue before. That's great.
Yeah, I mean, we get on these street courses, and there's no way to dodge. When one person stops on track, suddenly you have six cars stalled.
Well, this was a situation that just a year ago would have brought out a full course yellow because everybody mm-hmm. would have been stacked up with their engines dead.
Yeah.
And they did. Yeah, they had the anti-stall last year as well, but nobody was really sure on how to utilize the hand clutches real well.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the year's experience has really shown out because none of them lost the fire and they all got restarted without a full course yellow even mm-hmm. being issued.
Well, now bringing out the next caution was our very good friend Sebastian Saavedra. He has claimed the title away from Elio Punstraneves. He is now the puntmeister, Sebastian Saavedra.
I didn't think that Saavedra punted Hildebrand on that one.
Kind of hard to make the claim that he owned that corner, that's for sure.
Well, it looked to me like he was trying to take advantage of Hildebrand being down a little bit, and it was an incidental contact kind of thing from where I was standing. I mean, I might be wrong, but
I saw it different, but I'm not going to argue it too much because Hildebrand came out to be it looked pretty bad this race. But yeah, anyway,
JR was definitely having some issues, which we will cover more here in a minute.
Later on in the race, Sebastian, about lap 74, he ended up liking turn 10 so much where he took pride in his new title of puntmeister. He liked that corner so much that he put his own car deep into the turn, and you heard an audible smack as his nose cone penetrated the tires and hit the concrete.
Yeah, it reminded me of last year. James Jakes had the exact same crash in the exact same location.
Yeah, just for those of you
that don't know the track at St. Pete real well, that's coming out of an area called the Acura Advance around the turn at Dan Weldon Way and onto the back straight, which is part of the airport. going into the hairpin, and that is a very quick section of track. And any hits right there on turn 10 is going to be a pretty solid impact.
Yeah, his tires just wouldn't turn understeer and just went right into the wall. Cooked it a little too much going through the corner, didn't have as much tire as he thought. But this brought out probably the most interesting event of the day, because JR had some he came into the pits and took care of some issues that his car was having. Came out of the pits and started wailing and tried to immediately pass Simona DiSilvestro with the caution fully displayed at the time.
Now, may I remind everyone that earlier in the race, JR had actually passed James Jakes under yellow.
Oh, you're kidding me.
No.
I did not know that.
Yeah, they were coming out of the pits, and Jakes had the line on Hildebrand. The gentleman's agreement in IndyCar pretty much is you don't race on pit lane, unlike NASCAR. JR decided to try to get the position on Jakes right as they hit the blend line, and Hildebrand got around Jakes after the blend line. And for some reason, no one ever called it. But, I mean, it was very clear on the broadcast that Hildebrand got around Jakes.
Wow. So, yeah. So that at that point in time, you know, Simona was having something of a conniption fit in the car. I mean, it was the squeakiest I've heard her in a long time. And as she's calling into the, you know, her team's like, hey, we'll take care of this. Let race control take care of it. She's like, should I take him back? You know, no, let race control handle this. And as they were waiting for race control to handle it, it took care of itself.
JR handled it.
Yes, he did.
JR Hildebrand, and only what I can assume is he was texting his mom or something like that.
I thought he was tweeting, you know. Maybe mom said, why did you overtake that nice girl?
He also displayed his superior double parking skills.
Ooh.
By parking on top of Will Power.
Mm. Oh, ouch.
A little bit too much watching those monster truck rallies or something. I don't know.
See, now, where was Will Power positioned at that point?
He was in turn 10.
The infamous turn 10.
Will Power was slowing up because the two cars in front of him, which would be Elio and Hinchcliffe,
yeah,
they were kind of slowing up as they came through that corner there at turn 10.
So he was in third.
He was in third, and he backed it off to let them go through the corner and, you know, warm up tires and everything like that as they're getting ready for the restart. And Hildebrand just didn't notice it. He went up and over the back end. Basically, he was pinched between Will and the wall and took out the rear wheel guard on Will's right rear. And came up and over and ripped up the mirror and all kinds of stuff. Ended up being the end of Will's day.
Yeah, it was just dumb because you're watching the broadcast and you're sitting there watching, and all of a sudden they cut to a shot under yellow of J.R. Hildebrand's car mangled into the wall, and J.R.'s just kind of sitting there.
They're like, what happened? And then they show the replay, and it's like, oh, Will Power's a ramp. That's what happened.
J.R. just got some sweet air off of Will Power. Or as I tweeted the PR guy at Mid-Ohio, we were talking back and forth during the race, I said that J.R. Hildebrand is now driving the number 4 Gravedigger Dallara.
Gravedigger Dallara, I like it.
So that was, and to JR's credit, when he got back to the pits and they interviewed him, I mean, he took full responsibility for what happened. I mean, not that honestly he would have had any option to take full responsibility, but at least he owned up to it. So
yeah, well,
he's still a little green. I mean, he's done for a couple years, but you know. Sound like a pretty junior mistake to just not pay attention during that.
Sounds like he was pretty rattled this weekend. That just seems very uncharacteristic for him to have as many brain farts as he did in that one race. Something got him off his game. Hopefully everything's okay with him.
Everybody has one of those. I mean, even Dario had one.
Well, you know, we just hope it's not, you know. Sorry, the show notes I put what was JR smoking, and that's completely tongue in cheek. You know, I'm not saying that he's out there doing some AJ Allmendinger / you know Lance Armstrong style juicing, but this is uncharacteristic for him. Very uncharacteristic. This guy's been very professional since he's been in the series. So
Hinchover took power on the restart. And then overtakes Elio. After Elio slides coming out of the first turn, Hinch makes a very veteran move and takes a hold of that slight error by Elio. Leads the last 25 laps of the event, and hail, hail, the gang's all here. The mayor wins in St. Pete.
Yeah. I just thought that was interesting, pointing out that two successive restarts, he had to overtake Willpower to get a chance at Elio. I mean, Willpower got taken out later, but he had to overtake him on a restart to get into that position. And then, or else if he didn't, that would have been him being launched over by Mr. Hildebrand.
Right.
but then on the next restart, he had to overtake Elio. I mean, that's some tough competition to get past, both of those guys.
Well, with Elio, you're talking about the only multiple-time winner of the race in St. Pete.
Yes, and Elio has been known to have something of a wide car.
It's amazing how much wider it gets in that turn one.
Yeah, indeed. And kind of like we said in the preview for this last week, I love St. Petersburg for that turn one. You got the tight, twisty bits of a city street course race, but you've got some proper corners out on that airport track, and that first corner is great. You know, that super wide open corner with lots of runoff on turn one, but it's followed by an interesting kink in the track. So it's not whoever takes turn one. You still have to come out of turn one in proper position to take that second corner, or else you're not going to maintain the position.
Well, I mean, right. And that's not a 90-degree turn there at turn one. That's more of an S turn than anything else, because it comes back further than 90 degrees and then does about the same thing going into the second turn.
Yeah, yeah. So I love this track layout. I mean, yeah, it'd be great if they could open up some of the other corners on the track a little bit more, but it is a city street course the rest of the way around. But they've got that fantastic turn, you know, last turn through turn one and turn two complex that really makes the track something very worthwhile on the series schedule.
Then Hinch, after the race, dedicated the win to Dan Weldon, by the way. And may I say that Susie Weldon threw the green flag, and it was good to see her. She's looking great. She's doing well. It was good. And did you guys see the picture of Oliver Weldon from this weekend?
No, I didn't.
It was on the front page of Motorsport, and it was a picture of Oliver Weldon sitting in a race car at St. Pete. 1 second, I'm going to put this in the
chat.
That
was his newborn son, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go. And tell me that kid does not have his father's look in his eyes in that picture.
Oh, my gosh.
He's a serious little boy. That's great. That is great.
That's some Lionheart right there.
I mean, that's the spitting image of his daddy.
Yeah. Well, let's see. Yeah, this weekend they unveiled that monument to Dan Weldon right there at the track. It's a great plaque of Dan Weldon, memorial to him. Then underneath it, there is a row of bricks from Indy. Indy donated some out of their stock. And, you know, some concrete handprints from his kids and his wife.
And also, the winner's faces will be embossed onto the monument, just like they do the Borg Warner.
That's awesome. That is awesome. I'm glad to see that, because this honors Dan Weldon, who was very much part of that community. And it also, this may sound crass, but it's laying down a tradition for this race.
Yeah.
Yep.
And it's something that makes you say, this is going to last. This is going to stand on the IndyCar schedule. Because this is another link that this city has to this race, and another reason for him to keep it going.
Yeah, this to me is one of those events that's not going to go anywhere anytime soon, because let's face it, there's great fan support for that event. It's a great race. It's got sponsorship. It's not going anywhere.
Yeah.
It's become a part of that community, much like Long Beach has become a part of that community. And that's what IndyCar needs going forward, honestly, is more events like that.
Yeah, well, I'll
Speaking
agree to
that. Speaking of that, your hometown and out there with Barber.
Yep, we'll be making a little noise about a mile from where I'm sitting in about 2 weeks. So it will be more than likely the Willpower show. I'm already saying it's going to be Willpower first, Hinch second, and probably Dixon third. But it's going to be interesting to see how Hinch was pretty quick for one thing at the open test at Barber, and it's going to be interesting to see how he pulls it all together for the actual race weekend out there. But one thing I do know is we'll probably all be eating at Rusty's.
Nice.
Oh man.
So to glaze over the final standings for St. Pete real quick, your winner was James Hinchcliffe. The time of race was 2 hours, 22 minutes, 12 seconds, with an average speed of 83.593 miles per hour. Margin of victory, 1.0982 seconds. Second was Elio Castroneves. Third was Marco Andretti. Fourth, Tony Kanaan. Fifth, Scott Dixon. Sixth, Simona DiSilvestro. Seventh, EJ Viso. Eighth, Takuma Sato. Ninth, Justin Wilson. And 10th, Alex Tagliani.
Some things worth talking about out of that. Chevy.
And the Honda, only person Honda. That can manage the Honda is Scott Dixon.
Scott Dixon, you know, it goes.
He's
back.
Amazing.
Scott is amazing with I don't know. I just think very highly of Scott Dixon. And if Dario were able to hold it in for the entire race, he'd be up there as well. They're champions. They're very smart drivers. There's a reason that they have, you know, as much hardware between them as they do. Unfortunately, it didn't work out for Dario this weekend, but Dixon was able to hold a car in this race and keep it up there, despite whatever disadvantage there is with the Honda equipment. Takuma Sato ended up finishing eighth, dropping from second. So, you know, that's a good finish for him, and another good finish for Honda in a weekend that's clearly dominated by Chevy.
I'd just like to point out that the only reason Sato finished eighth was he got hung out to dry on some pretty poor strategy by Foyt. Otherwise, he would have finished far higher than eighth. Wilson had just had a steady Justin Wilson kind of day, and Tagliani drove a great race that probably nobody paid a lot of attention to move up from 17th to 10th. But one thing that I noticed was that of the five mechanical retirements that there were, four of them were Hondas, by the way. Boyer, Beatriz, Newgarden, and Pagano.
And that has to be concerning.
Yeah, because, let's see, Newgarden was plagued with the clutch issues that he was plagued with at the open test, and Pagano got a little part of that as well. Beatriz, nobody's really said what was wrong with hers, but Vaudier had a header issue.
That's interesting. It's not something you hear about very often.
Yeah, had an issue with a header, and that was what made him have to withdraw. Hunter Ray also, in his Chevrolet, withdrew with an electrical issue also. And I know early in the race, he was having throttle problems.
Now, in those cars, it's a digital throttle, isn't it?
Yeah, the clutch and the throttle are all digital.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, it's all made into a box that is made by, I want to say, Cosworth.
No, it's McLaren ECU.
McLaren.
Yeah, it's McLaren ECU. But it's interesting that you have one Chevy mechanical, but then four Honda mechanicals. So that pretty much wraps it up for St. Pete.
Yeah, I guess the only other thing I want to that's my flipping beer cap, by the way. It's my notification on my phone when somebody texts me. Sorry about that. The only
At least
other thing,
my neighbors aren't revving their engines in the parking lot right now.
Nice. The other thing to note is that Tony Kanaan and Simona really finished well for KV Racing. Fourth and sixth, consistent results from both teammates. And Simona probably could have finished higher if her tires didn't fall off the cliff like they did. That's really encouraging for KV. Very encouraging. And potentially it's showing that they're working well together.
That was one thing that they discussed at the open test was how well they actually worked together. And TK was funny about how he was having to remember to be patient with Simona because she wouldn't necessarily do things the way that he does.
Mm-hmm.
But that he can also learn from the way that she does things as well. So,
she qualified better than him, so...
It seemed like a little sister, big brother kind of situation.
That's a pretty good relationship. I think we're going to see more of that, and I expect great things from her this year. She's obviously proven herself with the right hardware. I mean, I remember 2 years ago, right, with the old equipment, she was on a chassis that was like 2 years older than everybody else's, so it was like heavier.
Pork chop.
And she still did well. You know, yeah. I remember watching her out at, Sonoma or something like that? And she was doing great. She was up there. She was like seventh or something. That's what she ended up finishing. And she was in this freaking tank compared to everybody else's car.
Yeah, that was that car was named Porkchop. It was a first generation IR04 chassis that had been updated. It was literally the oldest chassis in the field, and it was the one that Marco Andretti won his first race at Sonoma in. Because it's back in Andretti possession now.
Right. And so he goes from that to, you know, finally everybody's on equal hardware, except for she has the anchor of an engine.
Nice.
Damn it, you know. And this year finally gets the sweet spot with KV Racing and getting the Chevy power with, you know, with the right hardware and people behind it. That's just great to see.
Yeah. And so leading your driver's standings is James Hinchcliffe. No big surprise because he won the race in his first race of the season. So the driver's points follow in with the race results. No big deal. The only thing that really kind of throws into that, James came away from the weekend with 51 points because he led a lap. So he gets an extra point. That's new for IndyCar this year. Anybody who leads a lap during a race gets an extra bonus point. Otherwise, the point standings remain the same as previous seasons, you know, as far as the award of points goes. So 50 points for the win, one for the leading the most laps, and then you'd get, what, two for pole position and one for leading the most laps, one for leading a lap, and then two for the pole position. So there we go. And something to point out, NBC Sports has some actual decent stats pages on their website. A whole lot easier to deal with than the PDFs that the IndyCar series continues to push out, or dealing with their go to their stats page and then click a bunch of click boxes until you get the right page you want to show up. So, IndyCar website is still as bad as it's always been.
I just use the media side. It's a lot easier to get to there, but I know everybody doesn't have access to that.
I had access to it, but I forgot my access codes and things. So anyway.
Hey, Mike.
Yes.
Knock, knock.
Who dat?
Tony George.
Hide your children.
Hide your kids, hide your wife, because the IndyCar rapist is all up in here.
Oh, no.
As in raping the dignity away from the IndyCar series, but he's back on the Holman and Company board directors. Woo!
Is there any surprise that he's back, though, really?
No, and I'm going to tell you right now, I've heard a lot of people bemoan this, but he does not have the power that he once had. Well, and as long as Mark Miles is around, he will not have that power.
Yeah. I've heard some interesting things, though, some rumbles that the team owners really want him to be their representative. Ah, stupid. Ugh, sorry.
Now what I just heard was Panther Racing wants him to be their representative.
Nice. I'm sorry, I had one of those pop up. Hey, we're going to play a video right as you open this website. So, yeah, anyway.
Yay.
A couple of the teams have said that they want him to be their representative, and Chevy has made indications that they want him to be their representative on this new IndyCar committee that's been formed or whatever. So it sounds like they're wanting him back in, but I don't quite understand this at all.
Why?
Well, you know, he's not a bad guy to have around because he clearly has passion for it. He knows how the sport's run. He's got the history in it. But as long as you keep him away from that top role, he's fine to have around.
Well, I think it's...
He has a history of mucking it up, though.
Well, I think it's a very fair statement to say that the truth of this whole situation is somewhere in the middle. One side wants to vilify him. One side wants to rejoice and say that he was the greatest thing that ever happened. There's truth in the middle there.
Yeah, he was neither.
but regardless of that... regardless of which side you come down on, whether he was, you know, the second coming of Rick Mears and God incarnate and all those kind of things altogether, or he was Satan come to, you know, take away open wheel racing from the masses. Bad analogy, sorry. But anyway, whatever you think, he's not a guy you want anywhere associated with IndyCar because he's polarizing and he brings right. back an era that nobody really wants to go back into right now.
Yeah, I mean, you can understand that I come into this from a kart standpoint. I was a kart fan, and naturally, I have a pretty good bit of disdain for the guy to begin with. I just really hope that Martin Miles seems to be a very strong leader, for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hoping that his view on it is that Tony is welcome to come play as long as he doesn't have too much power.
Yeah. You know, there still has to be this recognition that while Mark Miles is a new CEO of Holman and Company, and they're kind of bringing a new era of management to the IndyCar series, and you know, as he talked about in some of his media comments this weekend, they're going to take the Indianapolis Motor Speedway staff and the IndyCar staff and kind of mergify them and blendificate them and all that kind of stuff and come up with, you know, a single management structure for both units, which mm-hmm. makes sense. It still has to be recognized that this is a Holman and Company property, that the Holman family still runs this whole schmozzle. Yeah. And if mom says, you know, I love my son and I'd really like him to be involved, could you at least make a little spot for him? Keep him out of trouble.
It's kind of like putting Tony Jr. in charge of Indy Lights, you know?
Yeah, well, Tony Jr. has done a decent job with Indy Lights, but I think that some of the decisions made by the series has made it difficult for him to do that decent job. Like, hey, no new chassis.
Oh, Lordy.
Yeah.
Lordy.
So the last thing we really need to talk about in the IndyCar series tonight is Mr. Cheap Ganassi and his comments about Honda and their slow start for the season.
Slow is never the operative word.
Yeah.
I will never forget Dixon's comments one time about Chip's wheel. I forgot what series it was, but somebody, it may have been a NASCAR, but somebody threw a steering wheel. And Dixon came to say that he was quickly reminded that an IndyCar steering wheel is like $25,000-$30,000 and that it belonged to Chip.
Nice.
It was not his steering wheel to throw. It was Chip's wheel. And you break Chip's wheel, you buy Chip's wheel.
I remember Dixon referring to Chip Ganassi as Cheap Ganassi at one point.
Oh, yeah.
That was in response to contract negotiations or something, but it's well known that he is bottom line oriented. He doesn't have the billions that are behind the Penske name. But anyway, comments from him. I think Honda has some work to do, but I think they know that. They were mission accomplished last year at the right time when it counted the most. He's talking about Indy. But to have to rely on this again, it's a tall order. They need to understand the task at hand a little more.
Uh-huh. Are they going to get that another one of those, oh, by the way, suddenly we got to have this engineering change to a new turbo?
Yeah, I don't think we want to rehash that whole argument because there was that was a mess. It was handled poorly by the series. It sounds like it should have been allowed by the rules, but it was handled so poorly by the series that they lost a lot of hearts. We'll just put it that way. Chip went on. He said, Honda said for years and years and years they want competition, and now they got competition, and they're not talking about winning. I feel like they want to sit around and hold hands and sing Kumbaya. I want to win.
I want to win.
If you wanted to win, you probably should have went with Chevy. And here's why. Because Chevy is made by Ilmor. You know, the same people that made that Honda engine that used to win and beat Toyota and Chevy's pants off. And then Toyota and Chevy left the series because they were getting their pants beat off. Then Honda said, we can do this in-house. We can do it better. So they took it in-house, and Chevy went over to Ilmor with a little help from Mr. Roger Penske and said, you know, we'd like to get back in the IndyCar series. You think you could help us out? And said, we kind of know what we're doing in this series. How about we help you out? Sorry, Mr. Gadassi, but you chose the wrong horse.
Well, yeah. Penske had already chosen the Chevy horse, so it was going to be pretty difficult for Chip to choose the same one.
True. I guess those billions of dollars that Penske has to his name probably helped it so that he could stack the deck in his own favor. He just didn't count on the Andretti's being better than him.
Well, and the fact that the captain owns Ilmor.
Well, that too, you know. I guess you can't play favorites though with the engines the way that it used to be able to do it, and Andretti seems to be getting the same engine. Crap.
Yeah, exactly.
That's pretty much going to do it for IndyCar right there. Some quick Mazda Road to Indy notes. To absolutely no one's surprise, Jack Hawksworth won the St. Petersburg 100 IndyCar race,
beating 8 other competitors to the line.
Hey, everyone in that race got a top 10 finish, okay?
That's true. I mean, just think of how good that's going to be on their resumes when they go to NASCAR.
I mean, Ethan Ringel didn't even turn a lap, and he still got a top 10.
Look at that there resume. It got all them top 10s on it. That is so cool. You should be on our team. You'll fit in right here in NASCAR land.
Finished every race in the 2013 Indy Lights season top 10.
Right.
Sorry.
But, you know, I bet that car is about as tuned out as a NASCAR is, so being it's so old.
Yes, they've had some time to work out that formula, haven't they?
Jeez.
There wasn't a whole lot of on-track action, really, in that race. There were 3 leaders. Carlos Munoz led lap 1. Gabby Chavez led laps 2 through 10. And then when Jack Hawksworth finally decided that he was bored enough to race, he led laps 11 through 45 and pretty much ran away from the field. I mean, the margin of victory was 5 seconds.
No.
Wow.
There was
Munoz got the pole for the race, so, you know, at least something happened favorable for another team.
Yeah, Munoz got the pole for the race and then promptly got punted by Gabby Chavez 10 laps into it, which the funny thing was is Chavez took himself out in that process. Now,
is that a Saavedra understudy that you're speaking of there?
I think he's taking Gus Yakiman's place.
Nice.
No, actually Goncalves probably is taking Yakiman's place because Goncalves has been in Indy Lights for about 10 years now, I think. But, yeah, Chavez took out Munoz. Chavez got himself taken out. Munoz got dumped pretty far back in the field and had to work his way back around, back up. Hawksworth, though, is just superior. I mean, he's the best driver in the field in the best equipment in the field. Yes, he's driving the 77 Schmidt entry. So that's really all you can say about that.
Yeah.
Fastest lap, lap 26 by Carlos Munoz at minute 7. Fastest lead lap was Hawksworth on lap 22 at a minute 8. Everybody is on the same equipment, obviously. Ethan Ringel didn't even start the race because of a mechanical issue. So there you go. That was Indy Lights in St. Petersburg.
Nice.
So let it be written, so let it be done.
USF 2000, Hargrove won race 1 and race 2.
And Matty Brabb took the Pro Mazda race to no one's surprise.
No fault.
Shout out to Peter Dempsey at Ballardi real quick. He's going to be sending us his blog soon from St. Pete, and I'll be seeing him in a couple of weeks at Barber.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. Now, the other action from the weekend, the World Challenge did take place, their first rounds, race 1 and 2 of their series this weekend, Sports Car Wars, as they like to call themselves. And if you're not familiar or have not seen World Challenge before, get to a track that is hosting them because they're fantastic to watch. And something worth pointing out is this Audi R8 LMS that was brought in last year and homologated to the series seems to be doing pretty well. because they won race two with James Sofronis. Race one was taken by Alex Figge after Ryan Dalziel's Porsche had some issues with its splitter not being quite in the technical regulations. They probably found some jet fuel in it or something NASCAR-ish going on. Oh, come on.
Yeah.
That's worth a laugh. Come on. Thank you. I've got a laugh track.
The C post on his rear, on his wing was not to standard or something like that. Yeah, one of those.
And then, so Alex Figge in his Volvo ended up taking the win. Now, that's kind of interesting because Randy Probst has been like the master of this series for several years in his Volvo, and Alex Figge has kind of been the understudy in that program. So very cool to see Figge getting a win. Like I said, James Sofronis ended up taking race two in that Audi R8 LMS. And it's good to see new manufacturers getting involved with the series. You know, they got involved last year and continued their involvement in this year. So very cool. Very cool to see. I mean, continuing in GT, you've got the Audi R8, you've got the Volvo S60, you've got the Cadillac CTS-V, you've got the Chevy Corvettes, you've got the Porsche 911s, you've got the Mercedes-Benz AMG SLS. It is loaded with manufacturers. And these on GTR, it is worth watching, very worth watching. So get on their website because they broadcast all these races on their website.
Now on to the wonderful world of Formula One with a little Malaysia wrap-up action. FIA still having some issues with the Tata telemetry.
Yeah, so telemetry issues that they're having. Their communications to the cars, as in bringing on lights in the cockpit to indicate flag statuses, whether it's yellow or green or what have you, the blue flags, all of that was something that they could communicate to the cockpit and have show up automatically. The other thing that this takes care of is the DRS and when you can and can't enable the DRS. So, for example, when there's a wreck in turn one right at the end of the DRS zone, they could disable the DRS automatically by pushing a button, and the cars would not enable or disable the DRS. Now they can't control that, and the drivers have to be monitored to make sure that they don't deploy the DRS when they shouldn't. The other thing that it takes care of is the funky timing they do. When they get a caution on the track, when they get a safety car period, the pits are usually open unless there's some reason that the pits can't be open due to the location of the accident. So what they'll do is they'll leave the pits open under caution, but they'll give each car a maximum, a time threshold. They cannot get to the pits before this time threshold or they'll be penalized. So the cars can't race around to get back to the pits to improve their position. So they give these cars a minimum time to get to the pits, and the cars have to maintain that time or else they get penalized. Well, that part of the communication isn't working either, so they have to come up with a way around that. So I don't know what's going on with this, all this technology that's going on, but apparently they hired the same people that World Rally hired to do their timing and scoring. Maybe they need to call stage one.
Ain't that the truth?
But there weren't any safety car periods this weekend at Malaysia, so that didn't get tested too much. But obviously, the teams are quite upset about this because this is a major, major issue to have. Everybody's supposed to be on the same playing field, and when this telemetry and timing and scoring and all this kind of stuff isn't working totally correctly, it makes you look at the FIA, who's getting all, you know, the sport that's generating so much money, and they can't get this taken care of. So anyway.
I think that FIA has been just trying to cut corners on costs in just all the wrong areas.
Potentially, I think you're right. I think you're right. Aggregate practice times for the weekend. Hey, shocker, Sebastian Vettel was quickest. He ended up quickest practice times through the practice sessions. Hamilton ended up second, and Raikkonen for Lotus ended up third on the practice sheets. But does it matter? Because we're talking about practice.
Practice?
You talking about practice?
Who would have ever thought that Vettel would have been in first?
Eh, I was just shocked. I mean, Sebastian Vettel doing so well in qualifying again. He takes the pole in wet conditions. Sebastian Vettel on pole. Felipe Massa starting second. Alonso third. Lewis Hamilton in fourth. Mark Webber fifth. Rosberg sixth. Raikkonen seventh. We don't really care about the rest.
It's true.
Raikkonen, however, was handed a three-grid spot penalty for some, you know, blocking shenanigans early in said issue. He got in the way of Nico Rosberg during qualifying, so he got a three-grid spot penalty for that. That takes us up to the start of the race, because that's really what we want to talk about, right?
Of course. Boy, that was well, first of all, you got to kind of set the stage of what it's like there in Malaysia, right? I mean, yeah. Here you've got these 90-plus degree temperatures with storms coming through.
Yeah.
So you get a squall of wet stuff, and then it just the track dries out in minutes, right?
Yeah. If you recall, this is basically monsoon season in Malaysia. And they changed the race start time a few years ago, supposedly to agree more with European viewers. But what it did was it put the race time right smack dab in the middle of the time window that every day it rains during.
Right.
And not just a little rain, monsoon rain. But this race was starting under conditions where the track was soaking wet, but it was really hot and it was going to dry out quick. Everybody starts on enters because of.
And really, it was the front first half of the track. The back half is actually already dried out.
Yeah, yeah. So you take the green, and things got a little dicey. Fernando was able to get by his teammate, even though Massa really did a major squeeze on Fernando. I mean, it was Schumi-esque. He came right across the track from the start, right into Alonso's side, and Alonso even flinched because of it. But that didn't keep Alonso from getting around him and challenging Vettel going into the turn two area. But
turn two, three complex, right?
Yeah, but he kind of overcooked it, and Vettel was going slower than Alonso, and Alonso nerfed his front wing against Vettel. And that is when
the sparks flying right from then on.
Yeah, I mean, it was connected to the upright on the right-hand side, but not on the left. It just dropped to the track, and sparks just started to shower off that wing early in the first lap. So one has to question, when they did get all the way around the track, because Alonso was actually doing well. He didn't lose position because of it.
He lost one spot near the very back of the track there. I think he dropped back to like third or something.
Okay. But
not much.
But not much. And that made Ferrari brave because they told him to just drive on by the pit.
They actually told him to drive on by?
That's what Ferrari said.
Really? Okay. Because I thought initially when I was hearing during the race, they thought Alonso had made his own decision.
Yeah, on the broadcast, I will say this. There's a bit of jump to the conclusion that Alonso's a jerk and he made that decision on his own.
Right.
By the broadcasters. And I was a little bit annoyed with that because they had nothing to back up what they were saying.
Well, and they said that, because any logical, they were in their opinion, was yeah. Any logical team owner would say, no, you're coming into the pits right now. There's no reason why they'd say stay out, right?
So the question really is, and this is what the team basically said, we told him to go by because we thought it was a worthwhile gamble. And they even said in their statement that from inside the car, Alonso couldn't see the damage nearly as well as they could from the pits. And they were basically saying that they made the call.
Gotcha.
Maybe that's to deflect criticism from their driver. And that may be. Okay. You know, I can't judge their motives other than to say what they said. And what they said rings true. They have a better view of that than Alonso does.
Yeah, the cameras had a much better view, of course, in detail. And so, yeah, he comes around, passes by the pits, gets out onto the long front straight, and
and the wing pops right under his car. The front wheels come off the ground, and you can see they weren't rolling because he had put on the brakes. But
yep.
That really doesn't mean anything when your front wheels aren't touching the ground.
Yeah, it just never stopped.
So,
just kept going
just
on.
Just ask Sebastian Buemi.
Yes, he straight lined turn one and went
straight into the kitty litter.
Yep, straight into the gravel, and end of race for Alonso. And you know what? He had a good car. He had a good car.
Great car.
And I think towards the end of the race, we saw that Red Bull sees that, or at least Sebastian Vettel sees that Alonso has a great car because he made some interesting decisions. This is really wild because it makes sense if they know that that car isn't going to fall apart and do exactly what it did, you know, with 100 yards of passing the pit entry. It makes sense if you can stay out for maybe one or two more laps, then come in and put on softs.
Yep.
Then
put on the actual slicks, not the rain tires, right?
But on the other side of that, how many positions are you going to lose out there trying to get around with a broken front wing?
Yep.
It's one thing to do it. It's one thing to push on tires.
Yeah.
But when you know you have a problem like a wing issue, and especially how much importance the downforce is on a track like Malaysia, then you have to bring them in when you know there's a problem. And I'm honestly surprised FIA didn't step in.
Yeah, and see, that's the thing. And they said it on the race broadcast. As soon as he passed pit entry, you figure the FIA was getting on the horn to let them know you can't let him pass pit entry again.
Yeah.
But until he passed pit entry, you know, there really wasn't a reason for the FIA to say, you should probably do your job and change that wing, because I don't think there's anybody at the track that thought it was a good idea for him to pass pit entry. When I saw him pass pit entry, I'm just aghast.
Because I was shocked as well. It's like, there's no way on this course that car is going to last another lap. No way.
What's the best thing that could happen? You run around the track, you maybe lose four or five more positions, because obviously he's going to be slower than everybody else behind.
Yep.
Then you come in and pit, and you try and get out there on soft tires. And clearly, it was not dry enough to be out there on soft tires.
Yeah, so because after just three laps, didn't Vettel come in?
Yeah, yeah. And he fishtailed around for quite a while.
You know, while we're talking about stupid things, let's bring up the Toro Rosso Caterham incident with Jean-Eric Vergne and Charles Peak.
Yeah, how did this all go down? Toro Rosso was released from the pits right into the side of Charles Peak.
Yeah, lap 7, Vergne was released, Peak was pulling in, Vergne T-bones Peak essentially. They came together, broke the front wing on the Toro Rosso, Peak was kind of parked all, as we like to say here in the South, cattywampus in his pit stall.
Yes.
FIA, the pit stewards impose a $10,000 fine on Toro Rosso, but Vergne's 10th place finish is left in place.
Yeah, that's a hard one. I mean, obviously it was the team that let him go. It's not Vergne who made the mistake. It was the team that let him go into the side of him. Lucky for them, it happened right in front of their pit stall, so they could just, you know, tow him back, change the wing, and send him again. But,
yep.
Ugh.
My favorite, though, of the pits was the first pit from Lewis Hamilton, where he decided to try and do a little family reunion there with the...
Hey, guys, how's it going? Oh.
Whoops, wrong one. priceless.
Yeah, if you didn't see the race, he pulled into the McLaren pit stall, making the same mistake that almost every commentator on the planet has made this season by associating him with the McLaren team, and then realized... Mercedes is just a few bays down. I'll go there.
Speaking of pits and McLaren, what about the little Jenson Button pit incident where he decided that he was already done?
Well, see, was it Jenson that decided, or was it the team that let him go when the tire wasn't done? I didn't quite get a good read on that one. Whatever the case, they let him go, and as soon as he left the pits, you saw his rear tire kind of slide out on the post a little bit and then slide back in. It's like, ooh, that's not supposed to happen.
Might want to do something about that, boys.
So they stopped him and pulled him back and put the nut on. Legitimately, Jenson was in fifth at the time, or would have come back into the race in fifth. He felt like he would be challenging for a podium. And seeing as how the Mercedes cars were being held up based on strategy towards the end of the race, he may have had a chance. But, you know, it's hard to say, obviously. But that said, ooh, you hate to see that happen.
And that wasn't the only issue with the pits. The pits were just going all nuts with this F1 race.
Yeah.
It was pretty crazy. Force India, I had to feel bad for them.
Yeah.
And they had these wheel nut issues where they just couldn't get the tire off or in one case get the tire on. It just, the drivers in there frustrated. Sutil was just going nuts. He actually ended up going out with one rain tire and three slicks on.
Which is an issue with regulations. But
exactly.
But what do you do? I mean,
we think that one quarter of the track will be what?
Well, you see, going through turns 3, 4, and 5, they're all left-handers, so we want that left rear to be a rain tire.
Now, you know, in rally, it's all okay.
Mm-hmm.
They do this weird cross pattern thing even sometimes, but yeah, it doesn't work so much in Formula One.
Yeah, especially when the regulations are, that shall be not allowed.
Right.
But, okay, elephant in the room. What do you think about team orders in F1, guys?
Apparently they're ignored.
Because we had an interesting study this weekend, because Nico Rosberg was begging, let me race Lewis, let me race Lewis. And Ross Brawn is like, no, hold your station. I mean, you heard him come over the radio like 4 times. Come on, guys, let me go. And they're like, no, hold station. We need to bring these cars home. We need the fuel sample. We're fighting fuel. We can't let you guys race.
Well, Hamilton was having to fight fuel. Yeah. I don't know if Rosberg was.
That may be, but they called the strategy and they said this is how it shall be, and Rosberg didn't like it, but he stayed right where he was, and Lewis at the end of the race basically said, hey, this should have been Rosberg's podium. I feel bad being up here. It says a bit for their respect for each other, because they were loving on each other after the race. These guys are good friends. It was part of the reason why Lewis went to Mercedes, because he knew he could race with a buddy of his that he had raced with for years. So
that was the least cocky I've ever seen Lewis. He was so... Yeah, it was the most solemn podium I've ever seen in my life.
He wasn't on Twitter, that's why.
I bet
Lewis is going to add Nico's name to his half sleeve that he's got going right now. I hear he's got a full back tattoo and a half sleeve going on, because they wouldn't let him do it at McLaren, and now he's at Mercedes. He has. So interesting world.
Hey, blood, we going to get... We're going to get 40s and rock 25s or something like that.
That's thug life, man. Don't put it down. Don't be a hater. Anyway, so that was the study of how you do the team orders right, because they respected each other and they did what the team basically demanded of them. And they're basically saying, hey, we owe you one. Sorry about that, Nico, but we're going to call this as we see it. The study of how you don't do race strategy came from our friends at Red Bull, who apparently, you know, we saw this as we're watching the race. Vettel comes out after his last pit, Weber comes out after his last pit stop, slightly ahead of Vettel on track. They dice for the position. Do I have that right, or was it Vettel coming out?
Vettel was coming out. Weber was clearly in the lead.
Okay.
And Weber was in the lead, he was actually already given team orders that to go into like safe mode from there.
Yeah.
You know, basically safety mode, and he detuned his engine, according to him anyway.
Yeah. When they came out from that last set of pit stops, Weber ended up in the lead, and they diced for position at that point, and Weber came out the leader of that battle. He was able to overtake Vettel through pit strategy, and once they came out of the pits, the team basically said, hey, let's keep it as is. They diced a little bit after they came out of the pits and all that kind of stuff, but that was it. And then the team came over and said, this is the end. We didn't hear that until after the race, but it was pretty clear during the race that Mark was not happy with Sebastian, and it came out why. It's because the team told them, like you said, guys, let's bring these cars home.
Yep.
Tune the engines down. We want the engines to last. We want the tires to last. We've seen the cliff that people have fallen off of. Heck, if you saw Mercedes on the last, or excuse me, McLaren on the last lap of the race, they brought in Sergio Perez with one lap to go and pitted him to put on new tires. One lap. And it wasn't for strategy, or it wasn't for, you know, meeting the soft, super soft requirements, because they started on enters. That's out the window.
Yep, they didn't need to do that, right?
They didn't have to do it per...
Once you use wets, you can use whatever you want.
Yeah, they didn't have to do anything per regulations. They did it because he was facing the cliff that Simona saw in the IndyCar race.
Yeah, exactly.
Fall precipitously off the edge. But... Sebastian Vettel went ahead and diced for the position, took the position from Webber. Webber's like, what the heck is going on?
Took the position. They're going down that front stretch, and Vettel tucks on the right-hand side, on the inside there, about 3 inches from the wall,
mm-hmm.
and 3 inches from a tire, from the front tire of Webber, to dive in and end up overtaking him on that first turn.
Oof.
That was some crazy driving. He could have taken them both out easy.
Yeah. See, this is where the FIA, I believe, set a bad precedent a while back, and I hate to rehash this, but when Alonso and Hamilton were having their tit for tat as teammates, and Alonso was supposed to get the better pit strat or the better, you know, Q3 strategy based on the team's, you know, alternating Q3 strategies per race weekend. And Vettel went ahead and tried to pip him for that and take that. Alonso said, not going to let that happen. So he sat there in the pits in front of Vettel so long that Vettel wouldn't have a chance to take the last flying lap. And the FIA came in and penalized the team for it. In my opinion, the FIA has no business being involved in the inter-squabbles among teammates.
Oh yeah, for sure. That's strictly within the team and between the drivers, and shouldn't go any further.
So if we want to follow the FIA's precedent, they need to get, you know, serious this coming week and penalize Vettel.
I don't think that's obviously
that's not going to happen. I'm just being tongue-in-cheek.
Nope.
But this is kind of a weird situation, because Vettel has wronged the team. The team came out, and basically Christian Horner was pretty dang critical of Vettel in this. Very clearly, Sebastian Vettel did what the team told him not to. From Christian Horner, he had the communication and knew what it was, and he chose to ignore it. He put his interest beyond what the team's position was, and he was focused on those 8 points difference between second and first. That was wrong. He had accepted it was wrong, and from a team's perspective, Formula One is a team sport, but there is also a driver's championship, and that's where sometimes you end up being in conflict, and I believe exactly the same conflict was going on with the two cars of Lewis Hamilton and Nico Rosberg just behind us. Wow. What do you do in this situation? How do you penalize Sebastian Vettel as a team? Can you?
How do you do it?
Three-time world champion, do you? Really?
Are you cutting your throat if you penalize Sebastian Vettel? Yes.
Yeah, you are.
Well, you know, there's already been talk about Vettel moving to a different team anyway, and you had
That's
to think that
say.
Would just push
I mean,
it along.
You threaten that, huh? Yeah.
You know, the other side of it is, as a team, Red Bull, they've created this dominant car. Enough people will argue, I'm going to say I'm among those that think Sebastian Vettel's a fantastic driver, but this Red Bull car has made him something super special.
Yep.
Yeah, I think if you took Fernando Alonso and dropped him in that Red Bull car, you get the same results.
Yeah, and I think it's safe to say there are many drivers in the paddock who could do amazing things with that Red Bull car. They've got a phenomenal product, and how much do they, how do I put this, do they need to do something just to maintain the sovereignty of the team? Do they need to make some sort of example of Vettel? Now, John Watson, a former Grand Prix driver of some note, he called for a ban on Vettel for a race, basically saying, hey, this team has to reassert their authority. Sebastian Vettel is now running this team. They need to ban him for a race to put him back in his place.
No, I wouldn't agree with that.
I would agree.
If he ended up taking Webber out, yes.
Yeah, I'd say that's fair. What does this do with Mark Webber, though? Because I think it's safe to say, you know, Webber's comments after the race were basically, I'm in this situation again. How many times is this going to happen? What exactly did he say? He said, they asked him, do you think they're going to do anything about about Vettel? And he said, they haven't in the past. Why would they now?
I'm even wondering if Webber's going to finish the season out with Red Bull.
That's an interesting thought, because in my mind, if I'm Mark Webber and I see that happening and I've had it up to here with this, I just turn left a little bit and put him in the wall.
Yeah.
Oops.
Fire me.
A little too tight. Oh, your telemetry says, it must be wrong. Fire me.
Or the next time that he is faster than Vettel, maybe he just kind of slips by and breaks late.
Well, see, that's the thing. If you want to rely on team orders in F1, if you want to rely on this being a team sport, you have to rely on your teammates to act like teammates. And now you can't, because now you know that Sebastian Vettel is not going to get any support from Mark Webber and vice versa. They're all for one and one for one.
Well, it reminds me a lot of, oh boy, this is not good. Oh, that's even worse. It reminds me of a couple of years ago. You remember when Vettel and Webber were pretty tightly contesting the championship, and somehow Webber kept getting the crap gear and the bad strategy.
The weekend they came with a new wing, and Vettel damaged his new wing, so they took the new wing off of Webber's car and put it on Vettel's car. And then Mark Webber went on to win the race, and he said, not bad for a number two driver, is it?
You know, that reminds me exactly of the year with Sebastian Loeb and Sebastian Ogier at Citroën, doesn't it?
Yeah, a bit.
You know, you got the multiple world champion who's going to get favoritism over the other guy.
Yeah.
You know, you're playing second fiddle, and they get frustrated. Well, what did Ogier do? New team comes along with big money, and, you know, he knows he's got the talent. He jumps ship. I would see that Webber would do the same thing if offered somewhere else.
Yeah. You know, you got to wonder what's going to happen with Mark Webber and Red Bull. Vettel is there to stay. I mean, there may be this thing about him. There are some rumors today that he had signed a contract through 2016 with Red Bull, and Vettel came out and refuted that. And who knows if, you know, what's going on with that. But this could be some interesting playing behind the scenes now because of this thing happening, and suddenly there's a little bit of a wedge that wasn't there before this, making contract negotiations a little more difficult for securing his future at the team. Bernie Ecclestone said this weekend that Lewis Hamilton was pursuing him and saying, hey, I would really like to move to Red Bull for the future. You know, this was before he signed with Mercedes, and I tried, but there wasn't a spot for him. And I guess Lewis Hamilton had approached Red Bull about a potential spot, and things just didn't work out. Now the question is, what would have happened if Vettel and Hamilton were on the same team?
I was thinking that, too. Wow.
It would be...
The tires would have been touching on that back straight.
Yeah, I don't know, man. That's interesting to think of. But I guess the next question is, what do you think about the potential of Mark Webber leaving the team over this? I don't think it's a big deal. I think Mark Webber's a decent teammate, but he's nowhere near the caliber of Sebastian Vettel.
Yeah, I think he's just gonna. I think he's gonna stay put for the rest, at least this season, and figure it out later.
I think it's safe to say that Mark Webber's retiring pretty soon.
If he's not retiring, he's definitely leaving Red Bull.
Yeah.
Yep. Exactly.
Welcome to Marussia.
Maybe he can take the Caterham ride to the next level.
So, race results. I guess we do need to talk about that. We've already said Felipe Massa finished fifth. Behind the dueling Red Bull drivers, Sebastian Vettel and Mark Webber finished first and second. Lewis Hamilton and Nico Rosberg finished third and fourth. Felipe finished fifth. Alonso, of course, retired. Roman Grosjean finished sixth. Good result for him in the Lotus, ahead of his teammate Kimi Raikkonen, also in the Lotus. That's interesting. Kimi was pushed back a few spots on the start, was able to basically hold station through the race. It didn't look like they had the pace they had the previous weekend. They had the tire things figured out at the previous race, but the tire strategy this weekend was kind of thrown out the window by starting on enters. Everybody started on enters, and it kind of put them all on the same strategy because there wasn't that bugaboo of how well you did on one tire or the other. It's basically just pick the tire you did better on and run it as much as you could. But other than that, Pastor Maldonado retired. Kerr's issues. Adrian Sutil and Paul DiResta, both with Force India, retired due to wheel nut issues early in the race. So that, like you said, that was a mess for that team, and they need to go buy somebody else's wheel nuts because that was a locking wheel nut design of their own. Then I guess we do have to talk about the standings. Red Bull is now in the lead in the Constructors' Championship, jumping Ferrari. They're in the lead with 66. Lotus Renault is in second with 40, tied with Ferrari at 40. Mercedes GP is in at 37 in fourth. Sebastian Vettel takes the lead in the constructor in the Drivers' Championship at 40. Kimi Raikkonen at 31. Mark Webber at 26. Lewis Hamilton 25. Massa 22. Alonso 18. Kind of a rotten weekend for Alonso. But the good thing is, like I alluded to earlier, I think this happens this weekend, this Sebastian Vettel going, you know, I heard the team orders, I know what they said, I know what they want me to do, I know I'm going to get in trouble for this, but I'm taking that spot because that 7 points in the championship that is sitting on the table, and I need to have them because that car is much stronger than it was last year, speaking of Alonso's.
Yeah, that's very true.
Say what you will about Vettel, he's smart. He may have sullied his pretty boy, virtuous young man status this weekend by doing what he did. In the end, it might be wise of him. Does it make it right?
That thing is two races from now, everyone will forget all about it.
That's true. And at the end of the year, there will be some interesting stories if the championship comes down to a few points.
Yep. They'll say it was the right move as soon as it gets close.
And people will argue, hey, the last great driver we had in Formula One that had multiple championships, that was his modus operandi. You look at Michael Schumacher, and that man was ruthless.
Yep.
To the point where he tried to wreck out one of his competitors in the world championship.
I heard about that.
Yes. He got disqualified for the championship that year because he wrecked out a competitor who would have won the world championship if he just finished that race ahead of Schumacher.
All he had to do was finish, yep.
And Schumi, all he had to do was make sure the guy didn't race. Anyway, whatever. Next race is Shanghai in 3 weeks, so we have a little time to let the F1 tabloid press ruminate on what has happened this week. As always, the F1 press is most interesting, and this should be fun. The only other thing to point out this past week that was really of note was Nick Fry has stepped down as the CEO of Mercedes. Nick Fry, a longtime CEO of Bar Honda and all those other teams that Braun and all that before. Now that it's Mercedes, they've brought in Toto Wolff to take on more responsibility with the team, and it looks like Nick Fry is out the door or is being reassigned in positions within the team. Still hearing rumors that Patty Lowe is coming to Mercedes next year, and we're not sure what that means for Ross Brawn. So who knows, maybe Nick Fry and Ross Brawn are taking the dregs of the HRT team and turning it into the next world champion. Okay, that was fun.
Speaking of Formula One drivers, but actually in the rally world, last week I mentioned that Robert Kubica was in that the rally in the Canary Islands, and this last weekend it's a 2-day event, and he got to drive. He's with Citroën in their little RRC, which is a little turbocharger. Got a huge restrictor on that thing to make it run similar to what the Super 2000s run. However, it has a little bit more torque. But it was great to see him out there. He was super impressive. The very first day, 8 out of 8 stages he wins. At the end of that first day, he was over a minute ahead of last year's winner, Kopecky, the other guy's name.
He's a man of some note.
Yeah. So, I mean, he just dominated. And, I mean, just he doesn't have that much rally experience. I mean, obviously, the experience we know most of him is that tragic accident that totally just tore up his arm, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in a scary, but thankful, day two, ended up having an event where he went into the Armco barrier, which, unfortunately, him and those barriers are not good friends. Day two on the second stage of the day, he ended up taking a little too hot in the downhill section because the Super 2000 cars were a little bit faster on the downhills than the RRC he was in. And as he's coming around, the corner was a little bit tighter. The back end stepped out and ended up going into the barrier with a 300-foot cliff on the other side. It was pretty scary stuff, but it held. And basically, he just had enough damage on the car. He couldn't continue. So back end stepped out, broke the rear suspension. Unfortunately, his event was done. So really, the excitement for rally, the European Rally Championship at the Canary Islands was the winner ended up being, again, Kopecky. So that's his second win of the year. And then Craig Green, if you remember him from the WRC Academy, and then also winning the Super 2000 Series with WRC last year, WRC 2 it's called now. He ended up coming in second. And in third was Daniel Oliveira, I think is what it was, who's a Brazilian guy in a Mini Cooper RRC, which is, again, turbocharged, little similar to the Super 2000s, but the turbo version. So yeah, that was a pretty cool event. And actually, surprisingly, Subaru was in fourth overall, which those cars are like twice as heavy. And to see it do that well on tarmac, especially, was pretty impressive. So, other than that, Rally doesn't have a whole lot going on except for 3 weeks from now. We have the Rally Portugal. Finally waiting, everybody's been gearing up to say that, you know, this is finally, we're away from the special events of the WRC calendar and getting into the meat of it all. We're no longer at a high elevation. We're not, in the super cold conditions or the changing conditions of Monte Carlo. We're on a standard gravel event, normal altitudes in Europe, as most of these rallies tend to run. So that'll be exciting to kick things off. We got another 3 weeks to wait for that. Things to watch out for that will be Andreas Mikkelsen will be out in the VW team, so it'll be his debut there. And this will be the first event where you see a lot more of the WRC 2 guys coming out, notably Elfyn Evans. If you guys remember him, he won the WRC Academy last year, so and just dominated there. So it'll be neat to see what he does in a four-wheel drive car.
You're still about a month and a half away from the rally in your neck of the woods, aren't you?
Yes. May 3rd through the 6th is the Rally America event here in Oregon Trail Rally. And I'm trying to get all set up to do some volunteering there, but I plan on attending all 3 days of the event.
Sweet.
And it is, yeah, a little over a month away, so I'm itching for it. I'm excited. I can't wait till they come to town.
3 months from now will be nice. A week and a half or a month and a half from now will be very nice. I'm looking forward to warmer weather. Most of the country, middle of the country, got dumped on snow this weekend, and we got just 2 or 3 inches here. And, you know, I'm just ready for it to be done.
Yeah, that weather sucks. Thankfully, it's been a little bit nicer up here in the West. We've been wet as usual, but spring's starting to roll in, finally seeing temperatures approaching 60. So that feels like 80, you know, right now.
Oh, yeah. Get outside in shorts and flip-flops. Exactly. What are you doing? It's spring. It's wonderful.
Exactly. That sun comes out with blue skies, you know, and everybody's, like I said, t-shirts and shorts, even though, if it was 60 degrees in June, everybody'd be having their jackets on. But 60 degrees in March, everybody's like, shorts and t-shirts, yeah!
That's exactly it, every year.
Well, I guess that wraps it up.
Yeah, I believe we've reached the end here. Mike Shaw, do you have anything else to add?
I think that about does it for me, but I was pretty excited to watch the F1 race. That was some pretty dicey and exciting stuff. The IndyCar race is still on my DVR. I only caught the last of it, so I'll probably be watching that tonight or tomorrow.
Cool. Mr. Watzel, what about you?
Nothing further to add. Great weekend. Lots of racing. IndyCar kicks off. Formula One had a good event, marred by the People magazine side of Formula One. But still, good racing. Got a chance to get out under the stars this weekend for a little backpacking. Man, I just, all in all, it was a great weekend.
Yeah. And I'd just like to finish up by saying that Joey Logano is a freaking idiot and deserved the beatdown that he got from Tony Stewart. And then nice. The verbal tongue, and then the tongue lashing that he got from Tony Stewart in the press conference later. I just saw a tweet come across that said that it looks like Denny's been released from the hospital, though. So that's a good thing, but I don't know how long he'll probably be sidelined. So, hope he gets better soon. So,
who was it? Two guys take each other out on the last lap of that thing?
Logano took out Denny Hamlin on the last lap of the Cup race at Fontana.
Yes.
And when Logano hit Hamlin, that caused Hamlin to go nose first into the inside retaining wall, which has no safer barrier. So.
And are we surprised with that happening in a last lap at NASCAR?
No.
We shouldn't be, because it's boys have at it.
Yeah, have at it, boys. That's the rule in NASCAR.
And then you get the whole fighting thing that's going on. It's like they're condoning this behavior now, you know?
Well, honestly, I'm going to be honest with you. I don't blame Tony Stewart one bit for getting out of that car and confronting Joey Logano.
No.
Because Logano had also taken Stewart out. So,
I agree with, I guess, maybe confronting, but there used to be a little bit more level of professionalism amongst these drivers. This is many years ago, but I think that's gone downhill.
Dude, you know what? Are you aware of what got NASCAR its first big time exposure on a national level?
Was probably that old fight way, way, way back when, right?
1979, Daytona 500.
Yep.
Donnie Allison, Bobby Allison, and Cale Yarborough fighting on the backstretch.
Mm-hmm.
And coming from the background down here myself, man, that is the joke with, like, the local short tracks and stuff is you go to a fight and the race breaks out. So, I mean, it's been in the last, I'd say, 10 years that NASCAR got very sterilized and became sponsor friendly, and now you're starting to see some guys kind of take it back to where it used to be. And it's,
well, the sad thing is this behavior from the drivers, while I'm fine with these guys, you know, getting each other's face and pushing each other around when they're unhappy, the reason it's happening is because NASCAR's condoning driving on the track that is crap.
Agreed.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's no place for it. That's the thing. And I think that's what Mike Shaw's getting at here, too, is there's no place for that. And there shouldn't be.
Well, sometimes we have an open wheel, open paddock podcast and a NASCAR discussion breaks out, so.
Yeah.
I think this.
Well, I mean, it was a big story over the weekend, and it really, I mean, honestly, we would be doing a disservice if we didn't bring it up, because now one of the things coming into question is, will that section of track have safer barriers installed in it by the time IndyCar comes back around?
Mm.
So that's
always something to talk about.
Yep. You know how it works around here.
Yeah. Well, I think that's it for the show tonight. Mike is off already. Kevin, you got any last thoughts beyond NASCAR?
Not really. Not really. Just looking forward to IndyCar in 2 weeks at Barber.
Sweet. Well, see you then, man. Have a good weekend.
Excellent. Everyone, enjoy, and I hope to see you next show.
Good night.